Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the Senate of the United States is sitting for the trial of the articles of impeachment exhibited by the House of Representatives against William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States.
The Majority Leader is recognized.
Mr. Chief Justice, it is my understanding that the White House presentation today will last approximately 2.5 hours, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. But I would therefore suggest that a short recess be taken in approximately an hour, around 2 o'clock, to allow the Chief Justice and all members to take a brief break. And I remind all senators that they would remain standing at their desk each time the Chief Justice enters and departs the chamber. If there's a need for another break, I will kind of keep an eye on the White House counsel to see if they need a break, and we'll act accordingly. Of course, I remind senators again, tonight, if you would be in the chamber at 8:35 so that we can proceed with the joint session. I thank my colleagues for their attention. I yield the floor, Mr. Chief Justice, and I believe we're ready to begin.
If there's no objection, the journal of proceedings of the trial are approved to date. Pursuant to the provisions of Senate Rule 16, the counsel for the President have 24 hours to make the presentation of their case. The Senate will now hear you. The chair recognizes Mr. Counsel Ruff to begin the presentation of the case for the President.
Chief Justice, members of the Senate, distinguished managers. William Jefferson Clinton is not guilty of the charges that have been preferred against him. He did not commit perjury. He did not obstruct justice. He must not be removed from office. Now, merely to say those words brings into sharp relief the fact that I and my colleagues are here today in this great chamber defending the President of the United States. For only the second time in our nation's history, the Senate is convened to try the President of the United States on articles of impeachment. There is no one who does not feel the weight of this moment. Nonetheless, our role as lawyers, as much as it would be in any other forum, we will not be able to match the eloquence of the 13 managers who spoke to you last week. We will try, however, to respond to the charges levied against the President as directly and candidly as possible, and to present his defense as clearly and as cogently as we are able. We seek on his behalf no more than we know you will give us: a fair opportunity to be heard, a fair assessment of the facts and the law, and a fair judgment. We will defend the President on the facts and on the law and on the constitutional principles that must guide your deliberations. Some have suggested that we fear to do so. We do not. I begin with a recitation of some of the events that have brought us here today. Although many of them may be familiar, they merit some discussion because they form the backdrop against which you must assess the evidence. I will then move to a discussion of the constitutional principles that we submit should guide your consideration of these matters, and finally to an overview of the allegations contained in the articles with a view towards focusing your attention on what we believe to be the principal legal and factual flaws in the case presented by the managers. My colleagues will follow tomorrow and the following day with a more detailed analysis of the facts underlying the articles. And at the end of our presentation, we will have demonstrated beyond any doubt that there is no basis on which the Senate can or should convict the President of any of the charges brought against him. Now let me begin with a brief recital of the essential events in the Paula Jones litigation, which underlies so much of what we have been discussing for the last week. On May 6, 1994, Paula Jones sued President Clinton in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Arkansas. She claimed that then-Governor Clinton had made in 1991 some unwelcome overture to her in an Arkansas hotel room, and that she suffered adverse employment consequences and was subsequently defamed. After the Supreme Court decided in May 1997 that civil litigation against the president could go forward while he was in office, the case was remanded to the district court, and over the fall and the winter of 1997, the Jones lawyers deposed numerous witnesses, and inevitably, despite the strict protective order entered by Judge Wright, and her continuing exhortation to counsel not to discuss any aspect of the case with the press, information flowed from those depositions into the public forum, clearly with only one purpose: to embarrass the president. Now, the principal focus of the discovery being conducted by the Jones lawyers during this period was not on the merits of their client's case. They devoted most of their time and their energy to attempts to pry into the personal life of the president. And Mr. Bennett, president's counsel, objected to those efforts on the ground that they had no relevance to Ms. Jones's claims and were intended to do nothing other than advance the agendas of those who were supporting Ms. Jones's lawsuit. The Jones lawyers, however, pursued their efforts to inquire into the president's relations with other women, and on December 11, 1997, Judge Wright issued an order allowing questioning regarding only, quote, any individuals with whom the president had sexual relations or proposed or sought to have sexual relations and who were doing it during the relevant time frame, state or federal employees. Then on December 5th, 1997, the Jones lawyers placed on their witness list the name of Monica Lewinsky. And on December 19th, she was served with a subpoena for a deposition to be scheduled in January. Consistent with rulings issued by Judge Wright in connection with the Jones lawyers' efforts to secure the testimony of a number of other women, some had sought to avoid testifying by submitting affidavits to the effect that they had no knowledge relevant to Ms. Jones's lawsuit, or that they otherwise did not meet the tests that Judge Wright had established before permitting this invasive discovery to go forward. On January 7, 1998, Ms. Lewinsky did execute such an affidavit, and her lawyer provided copies to lawyers for Ms. Jones and for the president on January 15. The Jones lawyers deposed the president on January 17, 1998. They began the deposition by proffering to him a multi-paragraph definition of the term sexual relations that they intended to use in questioning him. And there followed an extended debate among counsel and the court concerning the propriety and the clarity of that definition. Mr. Bennett objected to its use, arguing that it was unclear, that it would encompass conduct wholly irrelevant to the case, and that it was unfair to require the president to apply a definition that he had never seen before to each question he was asked. Indeed, Mr. Bennett urged the lawyers for Ms. Jones to ask the president specific questions about his conduct, but they declined to do so. Now, Judge Wright acknowledged the overbreadth of the definition, but she ultimately determined that the Jones lawyers could use a heavily edited version of the definition, but left in place only the two lines of paragraph one, with which you are already familiar. Immediately after this extended legal skirmish, the Jones lawyers began asking about Monica Lewinsky. Mr. Bennett objected, questioning whether counsel had a legitimate basis for their inquiry in light of Ms. Lewinsky's affidavit denying any relationship with the president. And Judge Wright overruled that objection and permitted the Jones lawyers to pursue their inquiry. 4 days later, the independent counsel's investigation became a public matter. And on January 29th, responding to a request by the independent counsel to bar further inquiry relating to Ms. Lewinsky, Judge Wright ruled that evidence relating to her relationship with the president would be excluded from the trial. She reaffirmed this ruling on March 9th, stating that the evidence was not, quote, essential to the core issues in this case of whether plaintiff herself was the victim of sexual harassment, hostile work environment, or intentional infliction. Intentional infliction of emotional distress. On April 1st, 1998, Judge Wright. Apologize for the logistical problems, but why don't I just hold it? On April 1st, 1998, Judge Wright granted summary judgment in favor of President Clinton, dismissing the Jones suit in its entirety. She ruled that no evidence that Ms. Jones had offered or that her lawyers had discovered made out any viable claim of sexual harassment or intentional infliction of emotional distress. Importantly, Judge Wright ruled that evidence of any pattern or practice of comparable conduct by the president was not important to the case. I want to take just a moment to read the relevant portion of Judge Wright's opinion. Not to demean in any sense plaintiffs with claims of sexual harassment or to suggest that we must be other than vigilant to protect the rights of all citizens, but simply to bring into slightly sharper focus the role that the president's deposition played in the real Jones litigation. Judge Wright wrote, "Whatever relevance such evidence may have to prove other elements of plaintiff's case, it does not have anything to do with the issues presented by the president's and Ferguson's motions for summary judgment, i.e. whether plaintiff herself was the victim of alleged quid pro quo or hostile work environment sexual harassment, whether the president and Ferguson conspired to deprive her of her civil rights, or whether she suffered emotional distress so severe in nature that no reasonable person could be expected to endure it, whether other women may have been subjected to workplace harassment, and whether such evidence has allegedly been suppressed, does not change the fact that plaintiff has failed to demonstrate that she has a case worthy of submitting to a jury." Now, Ms. Jones appealed Judge Wright's decision to the Eighth Circuit, heard arguments on October 20th, 1998, and on November 13th, 1998, before a decision was rendered, Ms. Jones and the President settled the case. Briefly then to what was happening on the front of the Independent Counsel's Office. In mid-January 1998, Linda Tripp had brought to the Independent Counsel information that she had been gathering surreptitiously for months about Ms. Lewinsky's relationship with the President and her involvement in the Jones case, and thus began the penultimate chapter. As you will see, Ms. Tripp's relationship with Ms. Lewinsky and her role in these matters is more than merely a backdrop to the succeeding events. Independent counsel met with Ms. Tripp, informally granted her immunity from federal prosecution, promised to assist her in securing immunity from state prosecution, where she had been illegally taping the telephone calls with Ms. Lewinsky. On January 13th, Ms. Tripp agreed to tape a conversation with Ms. Lewinsky under FBI auspices. And on January 15th, armed with that tape, the independent counsel first contacted the Department of Justice to seek permission from the Attorney General to expand its jurisdiction to cover the investigation it had already begun. On January 16th, that permission was granted by the Special Division of the Court of Appeals. Now, the President's deposition was scheduled to take place the very next day, Saturday, January 17th. On the 16th, Ms. Tripp invited Ms. Lewinsky to have lunch with her in the Pentagon City Mall, and there she was greeted by a corps of FBI agents and independent counsel lawyers and taken to a hotel room where she spent the next several hours. Ms. Tripp was in the room next door for much of that time. When she left that evening, she went home to meet with the Jones lawyers, with whom we know she has been in contact for many months, in order to brief them about her knowledge of the relationship between Ms. Lewinsky
and the President,
so that they in turn could question the President the next morning. As the independent counsel himself has acknowledged, this trip was able to play this oddly multifaceted role because, although as part of her immunity agreement, the OIC could have prevented her from talking about Ms. Lewinsky, they inexplicably chose not to. The existence of the OIC investigation was made public in the January 21st edition of the Washington Post and was the all-consuming focus of media coverage for the ensuing 8 months. On August 17th, the President's deposition was taken by the independent counsel for use by the grand jury. And on September 9th, there was delivered to the House of Representatives a referral from independent counsel Starr containing what purported to be information concerning acts, quote, that may constitute grounds for impeachment. The referral was accompanied by some 19 boxes of documents, grand jury transcripts, and a videotape of the President's grand jury testimony. The referral was made public by the House on September 11th. On September 21st, additional materials were released along with the President's grand jury videotape, which was then played virtually nonstop on every television station in the country during that day. The committee held a total of 4 days of hearings, one for preliminary presentations by majority and minority counsel, one for testimony by independent counsel Starr, and two in which the President was permitted to call witnesses and present his defense. In addition, the Constitutional Subcommittee held one hearing on the standards for impeachment, and the committee convened in its oversight capacity to hear witnesses on the meaning of perjury. The committee called no fact witnesses. Despite numerous efforts to extract from the committee some description of the specific charges against which the President would have to defend himself, it was not until approximately 4:30 on December 9th, as I was completing my testimony before the committee, that any such notice was provided. And then it came in the form of 4 draft articles of impeachment. 3 days later, the committee reported out those articles. And on December 9th, the House completed its action, referring to the Senate Article 1, charging perjury in the grand jury, defeating Article 2, which alleged perjury in the Jones deposition, exhibiting Article 3, which charged obstruction of justice, and defeating Article 4, which alleged false statements to the House of Representatives. And so we are here. But before moving on, let me pause on an important procedural point. Although the Senate has asked that the parties address the issue of witnesses only after these presentations have been completed, the managers spent much of their time last week explaining to you why, if only witnesses could be called, you would be able to resolve all of the supposed conflicts in the evidence. Tell me then, how is it that the managers can be so certain of the strength of their case? They didn't hear any of these witnesses. The only witness they called, the independent counsel himself, acknowledged that he had not even met any of the witnesses who testified before the grand jury. Yet they appear before you to tell you that they are convinced of the President's guilt and that they are prepared to demand his removal from office. Well, the managers would have you believe that the Judiciary Committee and the House were really nothing more than grand jurors, serving as some routine screening device to sort out impeachment chaff from impeachment wheat. Thus, as they would have it, there was no need for anything more than a review of the cold record prepared by the independent counsel. No need for them to make judgments about credibility or conflicts. Indeed, they offered you a short lesson in grand jury practice, telling you that U.S. attorneys do this thing all the time, that calling real live witnesses before a grand jury is the exception to the rule. Well, it's been a few years since I served as U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. So there may have been a change in the way prosecutors go about their business. But I don't think so. And so what lesson can be learned from the process followed by the House? I suggest that what you have before you is not the product of the Judiciary Committee's well-considered, judicious assessment of their constitutional role. No, what you have before you is the product of nothing more than a rush to judgment. And so how should you respond to the manager's belated plea that more is needed to do justice? You should reject it. You have before you all that you need to reach this conclusion. There was no basis for the House to impeach, and there is now and never will be any basis for the Senate to convict. Now, the managers have not shown and could not on this record or any record prove that the President committed any of the offenses charged in the articles. But even if they could, these offenses would not warrant your deciding to remove the President from office. In this regard, an impeachment trial is unlike any other. You are the judges of the law and the facts and the appropriate sanction. Before casting a vote of guilty or not guilty, you must decide not only whether the President committed the acts with which he is charged, but whether those acts so seriously undermine the integrity of our governmental structure that he must be removed from office. I want to deal here for just a moment with an argument that was advanced in the press by one of the managers, and that is that the question whether the offenses described in the articles are impeachable is not really before you, that it has already been decided by the House. As the manager put it in a press interview, quote, are these impeachable offenses, which I think has already been resolved by the House? I think constitutionally that's our job to do. Now, I trust in light of last week's extended discussion that the managers no longer press that notion, for it was remarkable in at least three respects. First, it's entirely inconsistent with don't worry about it, this is just a routine procedural process, leave the difficult decisions to the Senate argument so frequently heard during the proceedings in the House. Second, it's an argument that rings hollow coming from those who did not even debate the constitutional standards or seek any consensus on what those standards should be. And third, and most importantly, it arrogates to the House the critical constitutional judgment, which is yours alone. Far be it from me, or indeed anyone else, to instruct this body on its constitutional role. But I do think that it would help us all to be reminded of the words of Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Number 65. Because impeachment necessarily deals with injuries done immediately to society, Alexander Hamilton wrote, the prosecution of them for this reason will seldom fail to agitate the passions of the whole community and to divide it into parties more or less friendly or inimical to the accused. In many cases, it will connect itself with pre-existing factions and will enlist all their animosities, partialities, influence, and interest on one side or on the other. And in such cases, there will always be the greatest danger that the decision will be regulated more by the comparative strength of parties than by the real demonstrations of innocence or guilt. The delicacy and magnitude of a trust which so deeply concerns the political regulation and existence of every man engaged in the administration of public affairs speak for themselves. The difficulty of placing it rightly in a government resting entirely on the basis of periodical elections will as readily be perceived when it is considered that the most conspicuous characters in it will, from that circumstance, be too often the leaders or the tools of the most cunning or the most numerous faction. And on this account, can hardly be expected to possess the requisite neutrality towards those whose conduct may be the subject of scrutiny. And then the convention, it appears, thought the Senate the most fit depositary of this important trust. Now, the president may be removed from office only upon impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. The offenses charged here, even if supported by the evidence, do not meet that lofty standard, a standard that the framers intentionally set at this extraordinarily high level to ensure that only the most serious offenses, and in particular those that subverted our system of government, would justify overturning a popular election. Impeachment is not a remedy for private wrongs. It's a method of removing someone whose continued presence in office would cause grave danger to the nation. Listen to the words of 10 Republican members of the 1974 Judiciary Committee, one of whom now sits in this body. After President Nixon's resignation, in an effort to articulate a measured and a careful assessment of the issues they had confronted, they reviewed the historical origins of the impeachment clause and wrote, "It is our judgment, based upon this constitutional history, that the framers of the United States Constitution intended that the president should be removable by the legislative branch only for serious misconduct, dangerous to the system of government established by the Constitution. Absent the element of danger to the state, we believe the delegates to the Federal Convention of 1787, in providing that the president should serve for a fixed elective term, rather than during good behavior or popularity, struck the balance in favor of stability in the executive branch." Now, where did this lesson in constitutional history come from? It came directly from the words of the framers in 1787. Impeachment was no strange, arcane concept to them. It was familiar to them as part of English constitutional practice and was part of many state constitutions. It is therefore not surprising that whether to make provision for impeachment of the president became the focus of contention, especially in the context of concern whether, in our new republican form of government, the legislator ought to be entrusted with such a power. On this latter point, perhaps foretelling the notion that impeachment ought to be a matter of constitutional last resort, Benjamin Franklin noted that it at least had the merit of being a peaceful alternative to revolution. Now, Governor Morris, one of the principal moving forces behind the language that ultimately emerged from the convention, believed that provision for impeachment should be made, but that the offenses must be limited and carefully defined. His concern was very clearly for the corrupt president, who may be bribed by a greater interest to betray his trust, as he wrote. "And no one would say that we ought to expose ourselves to the danger of seeing the first magistrate in foreign pay without being able to guard against it by displacing him." Drafts, as they emerged from the convention, moved through one that authorized impeachment for treason or bribery or corruption, and then the more limited treason or bribery, until the critical debate of September 8, 1787, when, pointing to the then current example of the impeachment of Warren Hastings, George Mason moved to add the word maladministration to that definition. It was in the face of objections from James Madison and Morris, however, that this term was too vague and would be the equivalent to tenure during the pleasure of the Senate, that Mason withdrew his proposal, and the convention then adopted the language, "other high crimes and misdemeanors against the state." As Morris put it, "an election every 4 years will prevent maladministration." There's no question that the framers reviewed this language as responsive to Mason's concerns, to Morris's concerns, that the impeachment be limited and well defined. To argue then, as the managers do, that the phrase other crimes and misdemeanors was really meant to encompass a wide range of offenses that one might find in a compendium of English criminal law simply flies in the face of the clear intent of the framers, who carefully chose their language, knew exactly what those words meant, and knew exactly what risks they intended to protect against. Looking back on this drafting history, the 1974 Minority Report described the purpose of the framers in these words. They were concerned with preserving the government from being overthrown by the treachery or corruption of one man. Now, the managers have made fun of the notion that hundreds of distinguished scholars and historians expressed their opinion that the offenses with which the president has been charged are not high crimes or misdemeanors. Indeed, they suggested, not too subtly, that they must have signed those letters because they were political supporters of the president. To quote them, you go out and obtain from your political allies and friends in the academic world to sign a letter saying that the offenses as alleged in the articles of impeachment do not rise to the level of an impeachable offense. Well, as I understand the manager's position, it is that Gary Wills sold his intellectual soul because he's a political supporter of the president. Stephen Ambrose sold his political soul, his intellectual soul, because he's a political supporter of the president. C. Van Woodward sold his intellectual soul because he's a political supporter of the president. Is it possible instead that distinguished scholars of all political persuasions thought it important to offer their professional opinion on a matter of the greatest historical and legal import because they cared about our country, because they cared that the constitutional process not be debased? Perhaps if the majority members of the full Judiciary Committee had paused for even a moment to consider these issues, if they'd taken even a few hours to debate the question of what constitutional standards should apply, one might now give greater credence to the belated constitutional exposition that they have offered here. Instead, perhaps the majority was convinced by their own rhetoric, by the oft-repeated mantra that impeachment is merely a preliminary step in the process, and that the House need not be concerned with its weighty constitutional duty, and saw little reason to explore the constitutional underpinnings of that duty. Or perhaps they understood that a full and candid exploration would reveal that the proposed articles had no constitutional underpinning at all. Now, the central premise of the manager's argument appears to be this. Perjury is an impeachable offense, no matter the forum or the circumstances in which it is committed. Second, three judges have recently been convicted and removed on the basis of articles charging that they committed perjury. The president committed perjury. Therefore, the president must be removed as well. That premise is simple, but wrong. The first leg on which it rests was removed by the House itself when it voted to defeat Article 2, alleging perjury in the civil deposition. And the House thus rejected the committee's core argument that perjury in a civil deposition warrants impeachment as much as perjury in any other setting. As to the committee's view that the constitutional standard for impeachment requires that all perjury be treated alike, thus the House concluded no, and properly so. And as to the committee's view that it makes no difference whether perjury occurs in one forum or another, in a private or an official proceeding, again, the House said no, and properly so. What then of the manager's argument that the Senate's recent conviction of three judges requires conviction on the articles before you today? Again, they simply have it wrong, both as a matter of Senate precedent and as a matter of constitutional analysis. They argued that because a judge is obliged faithfully to carry out the law, just as the president is, each must be removed if he commits perjury or obstructs justice. Judges and presidents, and one would presume all other civil officers, if you follow their argument to its logical conclusion, including assistant secretaries and others, must, in their view, be removed from office if the Senate finds that they committed either offense, removed without a second thought. But judges are different. Indeed, every civil officer other than the President of the United States is different. They're different because before deciding whether to impose the ultimate sanction of removal, the Senate must weigh in the balance dramatically different considerations. First, the answer to the ultimate impeachment question, that is, whether the conduct charge so undermines the official's capacity to perform his constitutional duties that removal is required despite the institutional trauma it may cause, must be very different for one of 900 or 1,000 judges with lifetime tenure who can only be removed by impeachment than it is for one person elected every 4 years by the people to serve as the head of the executive branch. Surely the managers recognize that the Senate here faces a far different question, a far different constitutional issue than it did, for example, when it asked whether Judge Nixon, convicted and imprisoned for perjury, should be permitted to retain his office, or whether Judge Hastings, who lied about taking a bribe to fix a case before him, should remain on the bench. Indeed, a telling rejoinder to the House manager's argument comes from President Ford. On many occasions, we have all seen cited his statement in 1970 in connection with a proposal to impeach Associate Justice William O. Douglas, that impeachment is, in essence, whatever the majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be. But no one really notes the more important part of President Ford's statement 29 years ago. And I want to read it to you. I think it is fair to come to one conclusion, however, from our history of impeachments. A higher standard is expected of federal judges than of any other civil officers of the United States. The President and the Vice President and all persons holding office at the pleasure can be thrown out of office by the voters at least every 4 years. To remove them in midterm, it has been tried only twice and never done, would indeed require crimes of the magnitude of treason and bribery. Now, the Senate must ask here whether the conduct charged against President Clinton would in its nature be inconsistent with a decision to allow him to continue to perform the duties of his office. Just as you would ask if you had a judge before you or another civil officer before you, whether the charges are similarly inconsistent with the notion that he or she should be allowed to continue to perform those duties. As former House Judiciary Committee Chairman Peter Rodino, who surely understood the difference between impeaching a president and impeaching a judge, explained during the Claiborne proceedings before this body, the judges of our federal courts occupy a unique position of trust and responsibility in our government. They are the only members of any branch that hold their office for life. They are purposely insulated from the immediate pressures and shifting currents of the body politic. But, he said, with the special prerogative of judicial independence comes the most exacting standard of public and private conduct. A similar theme can be found running through the debate in very recent years over a proposal to establish a process other than impeachment for the removal of judges who fail to live up to the good behavior standard. Both the proponents of the proposal and the legal opinion offered in support of it emphasize that the standard to which judges must adhere is stricter than the impeachment standard, noting that, quote, the terms treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors are narrower than the malfeasance in office and failure to perform the duties of the office, which may be grounds for forfeiture of office held during good behavior. Thus, whether weighing the constitutional and governmental implications of removal or asking whether the accused can be expected to perform his duties, the Senate has always recognized that the test will be different depending on the office that the accused holds. This analysis is wholly consistent with the framers' intent in drafting the impeachment clause, that removal of a president by the legislature must be an act of last resort when the political process can no longer protect the nation. Nothing in the cases brought before the Senate in the last 210 years suggests a different result. Now, the managers also attribute to the president the argument that impeachment can never reach personal conduct. That is not our position. As I told the Judiciary Committee on December 9th when I testified before them, not all serious misconduct flowing from one of the president's official roles is impeachable. Neither is all serious misconduct flowing from his personal conduct immune from impeachment. Judgments must be made, and they must be based on the core principles that informed the framers' decisions. But the managers would, in effect, ask you to eschew making these judgments. They speak of perjury and obstruction of justice in general terms, and they argue that they are offenses inimical to the system of justice. No one here would dispute that simplistic proposition. But the managers will not walk with you down the difficult path. They will not speak of facts, of differing circumstances and differing societal interests. They will not, because they do not appear to recognize that those questions must be asked. Now, perhaps the one exception to this was in the very last moment of Chairman Hyde's closing, when he suggested, with what might to many seem almost an inverted logic, that a lie to spare embarrassment about misconduct on a private occasion was more deserving of removal than a lie about, as he described it, important matters of state. Now, although I submit that that conclusion might have struck the framers as somewhat odd, one can certainly conceive of acts arising out of personal conduct that would warrant conviction and removal. But you cannot ignore the circumstances in which the conduct occurs, or abandon the core principle that impeachment should be reserved for those cases in which the president's very capacity to govern is called into question. Perjury about some official act may indeed be a constitutionally acceptable basis for impeachment. Perjury about a purely private matter should at the very least lead this body to question whether, no matter how seriously we take the person's violation, for example, of the witness's oath, the drastic remedy of removal from office is the proper response. Indeed, in a sense, that is the message sent by the House when it defeated Article II. The principle that guides your deliberations, I suggest, must not only be faithful to the intent of the framers, it must be consistent with the governmental structure that they gave us and the delicate relationship between the legislative branch and the executive branch that is the hallmark of that structure. It must, above all, reflect the recognition that removal from office is an act of extraordinary proportions to be taken only when no other response is adequate to preserve the integrity and viability of our democracy. On this point, and here I'll fend off the wrath or maybe the scorn of the managers by quoting not a scholar or a professor, but rather a witness called by the majority members of the Judiciary Committee to testify as an expert on the issue of perjury, a witness who had served on the Judiciary Committee in 1974. Judge Charles Wiggins told the members of the committee this: when you are called upon, as I think you will be called upon, to vote as a member of the House of Representatives, your standard should be the public interest. And I confess to you, said Judge Wiggins, that I would recommend that you not vote to impeach the president. Now, beyond the question of what constitutes an impeachable offense, each senator must also confront the question of what standard the evidence must meet to justify a vote of guilty. We recognize that the Senate has chosen in the Claiborne proceedings and elsewhere not to impose on itself any single standard of proof, but rather to leave that judgment to the conscience of the individual senator. Many of you were present for the debate on that issue and chose a standard for yourselves. Many of you come to the issue afresh, and none of you, thankfully, has had to face the issue in the setting of a presidential impeachment. Now, we argued before the Judiciary Committee that it must treat a vote to impeach as a vote to remove, and that that judgment ought not to be based on anything less than a clear and convincing standard, a standard indeed adopted by the Watergate Committee 25 years ago. And surely no lesser standard should be applied here. Indeed, we submit to you that given the gravity of the decision you must reach, each of you should go further and ask whether the House has established guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And this submission is made even more compelling by the manager's own position, in which they made clear to you last week that proof of criminal conduct, in their view, was required to justify conviction. Now, lawyers and laymen too often, I think, treat the standard of proof as meaningless legal jargon with no real application to the world of difficult decisions. But I suggest to you that it is much more than that. It is the guidepost that shows you the way through the labyrinth of conflicting evidence. It tells you to look within yourself and ask, would I make the most important decisions of my life based on the level of certainty I have about these facts? And in the unique legal political setting of an impeachment proceeding, it protects against partisan overreaching, and it assures the public that a grave decision is being made with due care. It is the disciplining force, I think, that you will carry with you into your deliberations. Let me say that even if the clear and convincing standard that you applied for judicial impeachments, it does not follow that it should be applied where the presidency itself is at stake. With judges, the Senate must weigh and balance its concern for the independence of the judiciary against the recognition that because a judge is appointed for life, impeachment is the only available method for removing from office those who are corrupt. On the other hand, when a president is on trial, the balance is very different. Here you were asked, in effect, to overturn the will of the electorate, to overturn the results of an election held 2 years ago in which the American people selected the head of one of the three coordinate branches of government. Moreover, you have been asked to take this action in circumstances where, even taking the darkest view of the manager's position, there is no suggestion of corruption or misuse of office or any other conduct that places our system of government at risk in the two remaining years of this president's term, when once again the people will get the chance to decide who should lead them. In this setting, we submit, you should test the evidence by the strictest standard you know. I want to talk for a few minutes about what we see as the constitutional deficiency of the articles you have before you. When the framers took from English practice the parliamentary weapon of impeachment, they recognized that the form of the government they had created, with its finely tuned balance among the branches, was inconsistent with the parliamentary dominance inherent in the English model. They chose, therefore, to build a quasi-judicial impeachment process, one that had admittedly political overtones, but that carried with it the basic principles of due process embodied in the Constitution they had written. Among those principles is the Sixth Amendment's guarantee that the accused shall have the right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him. That right has been recognized to have special force in perjury cases, where it is the rule uniformly enforced by the courts that an indictment must inform the defendant specifically what false statement he is alleged to have made. This is not some mere technicality, it is the law. It's the law because our courts have recognized that if a criminal charge is to be based on the words uttered by a fallible human being, he must be allowed to defend the truthfulness of the specific words he used and not be convicted on the basis merely of some prosecutor's summary or interpretation. This is not some legal nicety that the House of Representatives can ignore, as it has many other elements of due process. This is not an argument we raise with this body merely in passing as a lawyer's gambit. This is an important principle of our jurisprudence, and I suggest that it is one that this body must honor. There's not a court anywhere, from highest to lowest, who would hesitate if they were confronted with an indictment written like these articles to throw it out. Indeed, if you want some evidence of how others have perceived this issue, look to the Hastings and Nixon cases, in both of which the articles charging impeachment specifically stated the false statements that they were accused of having made. Why, if the House understood the importance of specificity in those cases, did it not understand the, if anything, greater importance of telling the President of the United States what he was charged with? If you compare the closing argument of majority counsel and the majority report filed by the committee and the trial brief filed by the House and the presentation of the managers last week, you will begin to understand what has happened here. I challenge any member of the Senate, indeed any manager, to identify the charges that the House authorized them to bring. Just to take one example, we do not know to a certainty that the House decided, or we do know to a certainty that the House decided not to charge perjury in the civil deposition. Yet to listen to the manager's presentation last week, one would be hard put to conclude that they understood that. They have, in essence, treated these articles as empty vessels to be filled with some witch's brew of charges considered and abandoned, and charges never considered at all. And both Article 1 and Article 2 are constitutionally deficient for other reasons as well. In particular, each charges multiple offenses and is therefore void, in the criminal justice vernacular, for duplicity. Because in a criminal case, and here as well, lumping multiple offenses together in one charging document creates a risk that a verdict may be based not on a unanimous finding of guilt as to any particular charge, but instead may be composed of multiple individual judgments, and though that risk is in direct violation of the requirement of the Constitution that this body agree by a two-thirds majority before the President may be removed. Now, the House responds to the President's concerns in this regard by arguing that, the amendment of Senate Rule 23, which prohibits division of the articles, somehow addressed this concern, and that our argument would undermine the Senate's own rules. But that is not so. Rule 23 was approved to permit the most judicious and effective handling of the questions presented to the Senate. It can't be that the Senate, in passing that rule, and you know surely better than I, decided to purchase efficiency in impeachment proceedings at the price of violating the constitutional mandate to ensure a two-thirds vote for removal. Now, 3 years after the revision of Rule 23, in the trial of Judge Nixon, this very issue was presented. And Senator Cole captured that problem. Although the first and second articles of impeachment alleged that Judge Nixon had committed specific violations of the perjury statute, the third article was a catch-all, alleging that he made, quote, one or more of 14 different false statements. And I would note for you that that language, one or more, was identical to the language specifically inserted into Article 1 at the request of Congressman Rogan during the Judiciary Committee proceedings. In addressing the propriety of such a charging device, Senator Cole said, the managers should not be allowed to use a shotgun or blunderbuss. We should send a message to the House. Please do not bunch up your allegations. Charge each act of wrongdoing in a separate count. Such a change would clarify things and allow for a cleaner vote on guilt or innocence. And Senator Dole, who surely knew something about Senate rules and precedents, certainly didn't think that Rule 23 bound the result in that Nixon case. He first voted to dismiss Article 3 and then later voted to acquit Judge Nixon because it was redundant, complex, and confusing. 33 senators joined Senator Dole in voting to dismiss the article, and a total of 40 vote to acquit when it came to a judgment of guilt or innocence. Senators Cole, Biden, and Murkowski each spoke about the danger posed by this formulation. And I look once more to Senator Cole. This wording presents a variety of problems. First of all, it means that Judge Nixon can be convicted even if two-thirds of the Senate does not agree in which his political statements were false. The House is telling us that it's okay to convict Judge Nixon on Article 3, even if we have different visions of what he did wrong. But that's not fair to Judge Nixon, to the Senate, or to the American people. Those senators were not acting in derogation of the Senate rules or precedents. They were acting in the spirit of fairness to the accused and in the very best tradition of American due process.
The chair recognizes the majority.
Mr. Chief Justice, I believe that the council has indicated that we'll just take a break at this point. Therefore, I'm just going to ask the Senate that we take a brief 15-minute recess in the proceedings.
Without objection, it's so ordered.